Okay, thank you all for showing up. 42 of you, that's not bad. I hope you've all managed to see the videos of me trying to lecture online. It's not a comfortable situation, but at this point, I guess you've seen quite a lot of us trying to do this on a computer, so you've probably seen it all by now. I've given you a very, very basic introduction to the most basic of machine learning, which is the k-nearest neighbors and the k-means clustering algorithms. So, first of all, does anybody have any questions to those talks I put up? So you don't have, at this point, just unmute and talk if that doesn't work for us.
So you call those algorithms machine learning, but why do you call them machine learning? It just seems like a normal algorithm.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Well, it's not an ordinary algorithm per se, depending on what you mean by it. I mean, machine learning algorithms are also just ordinary algorithms. What is interesting in these kinds of algorithms is that they're really driven by the actual values of your input. So most... Are you okay? Most algorithms will run independently of the actual values that you run them upon. Whereas these algorithms are very, very sensitive to the actual input you give them. So their results and their runtime will really depend on what is the actual input you're asking them to classify. So they are considered the basic of machine learning, just like a neural network is, which is also just an algorithm, but classifies the actual input and thus is very sensitive to the actual input.
Aske, will you please mute?
Was that okay answer for you, Heider?
Yes, thank you.
Anybody else?
Sorry.
Shoot.
Yeah, I just have a question about what's the best way to choose the number K for the nearest neighbors. I don't know if I missed that in talk, but...
No, you didn't. I hope during my talk says that 5 is the standard, right?
But really, why?
This is a good point where the science stops and the arts begin, if you will. It's very often dependent on your experience in doing these things. I will say, so 5 is the standard. The more classes you have, the more you usually have to go up. So if you have a binary classifier, like we do here often, or just 3 classes that don't overlap too badly, 5 is a good number. If you have a large number of classes you want to classify into, and they don't cluster nicely, then you might have to go up in K, but it's really something you play around with.
If I may also say, if you have a lot of data that densely populates the whatever you're trying to model, then your N might be higher because there are 20 that do look like the candidate you have. Whereas if this is not the case, and often it's not, then too high simply takes in parts of the face space, which is enormous, which do not match whatever you are, and hence it's not good to have just high N. But typically higher statistics allows you slightly higher N, but it certainly goes more like logarithm or, you know, nth root, something like that.
Yes, the convenience, of course, is very much based on the fact that this is a fast and dirty algorithm, right? So I would never promote to you that you use KNN as the algorithm. People used to do that 20 years ago, and we have all kinds of weird derivations of this. There's one called ANN, approximate nearest neighbor, where you lack the you relax the requirement of having the absolute best neighbors, but just something that you try to do in a tree to make it faster, and it's horrible. So it's really just meant for a litmus test, if you will. Is there anything here? Other methods will be better at all times. Anything more with the KNN stuff?
Couldn't you just split the data set between training and test to find the optimal K instead of just like a guessing it?
Sorry, I'll just kill my email because that came in with a big pling and I didn't hear you. Would you repeat that for me? Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, sure. I was wondering if rather than just guessing the K, could you just optimize it? Like a split the data between training and test and then finding what the optimal K is?
Yes, you could, but then you would jump directly into a classic overfitting problem, right? So it would be extremely hard to find the right K based on your training set and then hope that it generalizes to external data, right? So, but you can, of course, you can look at some variants of your inputs and say what should the K be. In reality, basically, if you need a very high K, this algorithm sucks, right? So it really becomes less and less reliable as K goes up. Not at least as K goes up, if you really need a high K. So if you need 20 votes to differentiate with which of two classes you're in, chances are that you're overfitting your generalizer rather than coming up with a general model. So low Ks are definitely preferable because it will also increase our trust in the result that comes out.
It's fun. Again, I see it as just a hyperparameter and about the only parameter there is to test here. And since there's just one, it's simple.
No, because what's really the real parameter you can play around with here is the distance metrics. So you can scale the important, you can normalize the importance of each dimension by changing the distance metric in that dimension. And that's really where you can go into. So when people use this as a real world end application for machine learning, and I emphasize that's not what we're promoting here, but when it was used as an end solution to machine learning, people would spend days or months trying to optimize the distance metrics to fit the data set as best you can.
That's right. I had a normalized data site
Exactly. And yeah. then it is the only one. And you are right that you can fit it, but you should be careful that you're not overfitting.
All right.
That goes for everything we do in this class.
Yeah, I was going to say that's common. All right, more questions.
Is it changing the metric the same as adding weights to the different points?
Yes.
They're completely equivalent?
Completely equivalent, yeah.
Okay.
You can actually mix metrics. So if you have metrics where continuous metrics does not make sense, it is possible to have some dimensions being continuous and others being discrete. In my experience, the added work to do this is not worthwhile the effort. So if you sort of need to start playing around with these things just to get to a testing result, it's better. You're probably better off trying something else. Keep asking questions, otherwise I'll move on to the quiz, you see.
We also have a question. So I'm still in doubt how to validate if you've done it right. So in your examples, you often had labels, which you could visualize. If you don't have the labels, then you can maybe visualize it if it's only in few dimensions. But if you also have high dimensional space, what is the strategy then?
The strategy is the same as with all the other algorithms we didn't run here, that you take a third of your data set out, remove it from the database, and then you use that to test against your database to see how often do I get a correct answer or not. So validation wise, this is just like everything else. Debugging wise, so trying to find the error or trying to figure out what to do differently, you're quite right. It's much harder if you cannot visualize it. It turns out that for most of these things, well, actually, as a general case, KNN does not like parameters that that are linked to. We would like the parameters to be independent. And because of that, you can, to some extent, simply take your parameters pairwise and see what it looks like and how well you're doing in a two-dimensional space. It can become a lot of figures to look at, but if you look enough at them, you usually observe a pattern of where is it that I'm doing something wrong here.
Okay, I'm still not sure about all of it. So if you have to take part of the data set out and validate on that, you need labels, right?
No, but KNN only works with a labeled database set. Yes.
Okay, then I have a question about the clustering. How do you validate if your clustering makes sense? You just hope?
Yep. And that's really domain specific. So there is no general way to figure out if your clustering makes sense. Without some kind of ground truth, all you can do is you can wave your arms and say, this seems right or this doesn't seem right. Often you will have some kind of ground truth. For instance, well, we know that the distribution is 85-15, or we know that the variance is this big, and you can test if your clustering matches those abstract knowledges of your data set. But if you use it without any priors, and if you use it without any context, it will just come up with a result, and you can feel like it's a good result, but it might be complete bogus, right? So this goes for all the things. This is just automated statistics after all. And if you were to just do statistics, you could get up with something that is significant, but doesn't make sense, right? So there you just have to apply your common sense. Does that make sense?
One little test you can do. Well, first, Sophus should ask if it made sense, or answer that.
Well, yeah, it made sense. Just seemed like you just hope and see and look. If it makes
cross
sense.
Your fingers, yeah, more yeah. or less.
The other thing you can do is you can try to simulate a situation where, for example, if you put in noise only and try to put that into two classes, if it finds two classes clearly, then you know that something funky is going on that makes it look good, but it ain't. But it's hard because you need to simulate something that looks like what you put in originally.
But it's a good point. That makes sense. It's and that's a general thing for many algorithms that you put up what's known as an evil adversary. So somebody who knows exactly what would be the worst thing for your algorithm and then tries to break it. And if you cannot come up with an evil adversary to break it, then you increase your trust in your own algorithm. But it is very hand wavy, and there's no way we can quantify the quality of these things, unfortunately. Without ground truth. Once we have ground truths, it becomes easier, of course. Yes? Should we move on to the first quiz question, or do we have something more? I assume you don't remember it, but it was very simple. No, actually, the first one wasn't. The first one is a long one, so I hope somebody made good considerations on it. So, how much time does it take a CPU to execute one calculation? Did anybody come up with a good answer for that? So one question is a cycle or a nanosecond? Anything more precise? A nanosecond is, I can tell you a nanosecond is way too high. It's okay, there's no, this is an exercise in abstract thinking, if you will, or reduction. So one over the processor speed, at least, is an interesting metric. It's not quite right, but obviously it's not quite wrong either. So what does one over the clock frequency give us? You're welcome to just unmute and talk now.
I mean, it's the same answer as before. It's a cycle, how long it takes to go through one.
Right. So let's try this in absolute terms. How fast is a fast CPU these days? So one says 1/2.5 gigahertz, 3 gigahertz, any higher? 3.4. Somebody's a gamer, I guess. 5 gigahertz. Yes. So somebody says 5. That's about the right answer right now. The fastest CPU can go and buy is 5 gigahertz. So what does that mean? That what is the length of one clock cycle then?
1/5 of a nanometer. Nanosecond.
So 0.2 nanoseconds. Yes. Correct.
But you can also make calculations on a GPU, and then we have more things, and I don't know if that's another.
We're talking about a CPU now. We can move it on to the GPU or not. But even the CPU, does that make more or less than one calculation per clock cycle, do you think?
What?
So one is crazy more, many more, yes. So, and then of course, it depends on your CPU. But let's say we have an x86 type of CPU, which you will all have, unless somebody's really super nerdy, you will have an x86 CPU, Intel or AMD. How many instructions per clock cycle does such a thing make? So somebody says if it has multiple threads, yeah. So your CPU can have many cores. Let's try to just play around with one core for now. Your CPU will have many cores. There is no such thing as a single core CPU anymore. But even within one core, do you think we make more or less than one calculation per clock cycle?
More.
How many? You're allowed to guess. I'm not. I can tell you the computer scientists don't know these answers either. I'm trying to get to a point here, not just let's play a guessing game. From 2 to 32, okay, that's 2 to 4 is, and 2 to 32, depending on what. So basically, you're right. So your standard x86 CPU will have 2 integer pipelines and 2 floating point pipelines. 2 integer calculations and 2 floating point calculations in one clock cycle. That requires our program to be perfectly interleaved so that we have exactly 2 of each arriving at any time. In reality, it's more like, so statistically speaking, it's one in, there's 3 every clock cycle. So what we're getting to is that we can do 3 calculations per clock cycle, and the clock cycle was 0.2 nanoseconds. So how much time do we actually have per calculation? Can anybody do that number for us? I'm not trying to I'm not trying to trick you here. So 0.2 divided by 3. Yes. 166 picoseconds. Thank you. Isn't it? So now I'm getting... Don't you miss a number here? A zero, isn't it 660?
No, it fits.
It fits, okay, good. You know, since I began having this exercise, CPUs have developed. And now I want you to think as physicists again. How far does light in a vacuum move in 66 picoseconds? I don't like this quiet. Let's say 100 picoseconds. Sorry?
Some centimeters.
Some centimeters.
Oh, no, picoseconds, yeah, then it's like less than a centimeter.
It is. So if we say a nanosecond, right, gives us a foot, which is 30 centimeters. Yeah. So 100 picoseconds would be something like... 3 centimeters. It's 66 picoseconds. Two centimeters. Am I right? Yeah. Okay. Somebody did it quite right. 1.98 centimeters. I'll call it 2. Okay. So the exercise here is, of course, the time it takes to the CPU to do one calculation, the speed of light moves 2 centimeters, right? Less than the length of my nose. So, if we look at question 2, how much time does it take a CPU to read from memory? Somebody already sent out the link for that. Those numbers are reasonably okay. They're a little old, but not too bad, actually. So, if you all look at the GitHub Hillebard, somebody linked out, then these are not too bad. You can see that even reading from the closest memory we have, that number is 500 picoseconds. And if you have to read from main memory, you're up to 100 nanoseconds. That has two profound implications when we're talking about machine learning algorithms. What are those two? Reading from memory is expensive, exactly. So that's basically it for this class and for high-performance computing. The worst thing you can possibly do is reading from memory because it's 1,000 times slower than doing a calculation. And that has two implications we have to worry about. There's a good news and a bad news. What is the bad news? Well, the bad news is that we cannot possibly allow ourselves to look at every data point more than once if we're going to be able to do this at a scale, right? So if we have an algorithm that runs n squared or n cubed, like a matrix multiplication, something that means 1,000 times slower to read the memory than working on it means that we will die, right? We can make the CPUs as fast as we want. The real problem is that we cannot get data into them. So we should read the data exactly once and never again. So that's the bad news. We don't like algorithms that look at the data more than once, but KNN is actually good. KNN tries to look at it only once. What's the good news?
We can do a lot of calculations and they are not that expensive.
You can do basically all the calculations in the world because they don't matter. Yes. You don't have to worry about, do I have the time to do this calculation? Is it okay that I use an exponent function and stuff like that? You can do whatever you want because they're not that expensive compared to moving data. And that actually is a profound shift from, if some of you pick up a textbook that's 20 years old, it will say, oh, you've never used a tangent, or you've never used an exponent function because they're very expensive. Turns out, yes, they're very expensive to deal, compared to the other, like doing an addition or multiplication, but compared to reading from memory, it's so inexpensive that it doesn't matter. So the good news is we can make our algorithms arbitrarily complex from a calculation point of view, as long as they only look at the data points once. I hope that sort of resonates a little bit with you, because it's really, really different way of thinking stuff that you used to think, how can I make my program shorter? Turns out from a performance perspective, that doesn't make sense. However, if you have any algorithm where you look at your every data point squared, so for every data point, you look at every other data point, you will lose. Did anybody find the time to read them from persistent storage? I don't even design it here. We'll look at it in the other lecture I have to give here. I'll talk about how the things look, but does anybody know what is, if we assume that a stable storage, I mean a mechanical hard drive, does anybody have any idea how much time it takes to read anything from a hard drive that consists of rotating rust?
Based on how far, much faster an SSD is than a hard drive, a long, long, long time.
So, yeah. 8 million nanoseconds would be an ordinary, so 8 milliseconds would be an ordinary hard drive you go and get from Elgiganten. If you buy a high-end hard drive, something like half of that, 4 milliseconds, but no faster than that. It's really bad. So in principle, that means we're going to lose this. In reality, we can do stuff a little better because we can always try to stage in. So what's important is that reading one data point from a hard drive is horribly slow. Reading a megabyte or terabyte takes about the same time. So there's the difference between latency and bandwidth, and we'll talk more about those things in my next lecture. So the consequence is data is growing very rapidly. We can only read it once. If you need to do more than one calculation on it, you have to do it while it's already in the register of the CPU. Anybody has any questions or comments to that disturbing fact? So if we'd been in the classroom, I would have given you a long story about how back in 2004, this was actually realized that the problem was memory, and we stopped making the CPUs faster because it didn't really make any sense to make a faster CPU since it was waiting for memory anyway. Now we are getting 5 gigahertz CPUs, but just 2 years ago, the fastest CPU was still 3.8 gigahertz, which was exactly what it was in 2004. So guessing at your age, the first computer ever got was probably as fast as the one you can get today from a clock frequency perspective. Okay, nothing else? Otherwise, we move on to quiz 2. That's much more abstract. But does any of you here have a problem where k-nearest neighbors might actually work? That was a profound silence.
While people think about that, perhaps you can answer the what about GPUs, or do you want to save that for next Monday?
Yeah, is it next Monday? Yeah, my next talk will talk about parallelism and how we can make things wider, and also what we do to make things faster. But I sort of indicated there's a difference between latency and throughput. And we will go into depth on that on Monday. Yes, somebody says that the RSD example from scikit-learn would probably work with KNN. And yes, at least after you, they Fourier transform it, right? And then you find a point in the Fourier space and distance to that.
They Fourier the iris data set.
Don't they? The iris, the picture of the iris, don't they Fourier it?
With the iris data set, I thought of the...
The iris flowers. Okay, sorry. That was me who was wrong. It is iris flowers.
A flower data set with just 50 in each category.
Yeah, so that's the problem, of course. But actually, you can... So, 10 years ago, I guess, iris recognition. So scanning your iris in your eye was considered a cool... what's it called? Biosecurity mechanism. And what they did was basically take the lines in your iris, Fourier transform it, and make a frequency histogram, and then put Pinnacle into that. Turns out, based on that, it was extremely easy to make a colored contact lens and get through anything. So you don't see those anymore, anyway. Somebody makes a general observation that seems to work better in low dimensional space with clear boundaries between cases. And yes. So.
But doesn't like a lot of algorithms work better in low dimensional space with clear boundaries? That's.
I was about to say. So high dimensionality is the curse of any algorithm. Exactly. The clear boundaries versus the continuous boundaries. This one is definitely one that likes. Steep gradients, so clear boundaries. There are algorithms that are does very good with less clear boundaries. So the SVN is not introduced yet, right? Tools.
No, it's not.
So that actually does quite well if the boundaries is not as clear. This one likes nice discrete boundaries as well. That is true. So lower dimensions helps everywhere. And clear boundaries, and also if your metrics are, if your dimensions are sort of actual dimensions where you have the same units on them, they're not that interesting. But KNN is really good if you have something where you take the price of a house, right? So you can take the distance to the nearest school, the distance to the nearest shopping center, the distance to the nearest bus. They have the same metric, but it's very different parameters after all. And you can then scale easily and say, well, it turns out that distance to a bus is more important than distance to a school or vice versa, stuff like that. In those cases, a KNN is a very good alternative.
Okay, so to clarify, we've been introduced to this housing prices thing by Tools before, and in that case, he had variables that were some were just numbers like number of floors, which floor you're on for the apartment, and some were like classes that were just labels like, oh, this one is a post number, this one is in Österbro, or this one is in Copenhagen. On maybe like in another country, it's not necessarily a number that is. So isn't it hard to make a proper distance metric for that? If you,
as a postal code is not good, except maybe you insist that it's the same postal code, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So the zip code is actually very, very good, and you want to weigh that very high. Because the most dominating part of your price really is your zip code. So it's a really good number. The distance from Österbro to Nørre Bjenslev in northern Jutland doesn't make any sense because it's only this distance to the closest ones. So it's really important that you make a metric where you are only placed in the same zip code. Otherwise, you won't get anything useful from it. So the zip code is actually very useful in this context.
No, but it makes it like, what I'm saying is that if you just like blindly to take in all your variables and try to make a distance metric that includes all your variables, it's going to be a very difficult thing to do for the problem. So you, for those kind of problems, you kind of have to remove some variables.
Yes. Exactly. So if I think that the housing data set has 82 parameters, am I right? And if you just take all of them and say, well, I assume they're all equally important, then you'll get a poorer result than if you clean it up. And then you can then clean it up in two ways. Either you start tuning the distance metrics and putting more and less emphasis on different dimensions, or you make a sensitivity analysis and throw away all the parameters that turns out not to be important anyway. But that's actually part of why it's an interesting algorithm to still know about. Because if you naively took the housing data and put it into a neural network, it would take forever to train it. And it would be horrible because you had all these parameters that doesn't really account for anything anyway. So the KNN is very, very fast and very easy to tune and saying, okay, these are the five parameters I really should be working on, and the rest are less important to me. Christopher managed to raise a hand. Please talk with Christopher.
Is it in general, like, can you take one algorithm, say a tree-based algorithm that would be pretty fast, and then take the most important features for that and then put it into your neural network? Or could you run into a situation where the same parameters aren't the good parameters because they are different algorithms?
Overall, no. The information carried within a parameter is the same across all these algorithms. So I don't know if anybody done the work, but I'm pretty sure you could show that most of these are equivalent in reality once you get to what information can be eliminated from each other. It's just a matter of which is more easy than others. So overall speaking, no, you should not risk that. More detail, obviously. Some algorithms might prefer one extra parameters where others might prefer that they're not there, but it will be in the order of the same information you use, not completely different. Anybody else?
On the subject of where it works well, the data set we used in the first week with the jets, it's also work. It gets like to 11% without doing anything, just using it without selecting anything or anything at all. So it works nearly as well as the tree-based, like a couple percentage worse without optimizing it at all.
That's a great example of, yes, you could have used this to just convince yourself that, oh, this can be done. And then you can tune it better from there.
Yeah.
That really is the point here, that you should never ever use it in real world. There's a saying, friends don't let friends use KNN, because you can also dig yourself into a hole trying to make it perfect with KNN. And that's really not the purpose of it. Then let's move on to the K-means clustering, which is, as I said, computationally very related, but used in a completely different way. Does anybody have any data sets where automatic clustering would make sense? I hope the answer is yes. Yeah. So if somebody says any Any unsupervised system where you need to classify stuff, and the answer is exactly. So you can do the facials, you can do the iris, you can do all of these things, but it's really important to understand that this is also extremely valuable in physics. So things that come out of an instrument, and we need to differentiate between different classes, the K-means clustering is of huge value to figure out if we're doing it right. So you have a brand new instrument, you don't know quite sure what the signal noise ratio is, you do a K-means clustering and try to figure out that way. So somebody has a longer question, I'll just read it here. Yes, so basically somebody asks, should you do a principal component analysis first? And that's what I do, at least. The first thing you do is a principal component analysis, because it's also, if you have 80 parameters, it's still faster to do a PCA and then choose the four or five best to put into a KNN than it is to try with 82 parameters in the KNN. So the PCA, or there's a slightly better version than PCA now. Tools, do you remember what it's called? It's the one Joachim
used. T-SNE and UMAP are some of the better ones. But T-SNE seems to be the simple next move. And we will have Alexander present it later.
But really, I cannot emphasize this enough. As physicists, K-means clustering for classifying the results of something that comes out of an instrument is of infinite value, and something we really do use quite often.
And I would also say, typically what happens with new instruments and lack of understanding is that tons of data comes out and you can't monitor all of that. But sometimes it's going to give out completely bogus results that will ruin anything, and the KNN will easily see it. And that's where you should use it. But you are at fault if you do not at all consider the data. So better a cheap, fast algorithm on it than nothing.
Yes. That's all the quiz questions I came up with this time. Does anybody have anything else? Well, that was 45 minutes and more or less exactly as I expected, to be honest. I'm giving another class and it turns out the same way every time.
Well, if that is it, then I suggest we reconvene in 15 minutes. You can end this video, Brian, and we'll start a new one for the exercise. And we'll reconvene 15:15, where I assume, Brian, you will introduce some of the thoughts behind the exercises. I put them all on the web, and there we can discuss where to go from here.
Will do. See you in 15 minutes.
And also, I can say that I will give 15 minutes on the small project, because we officially have kickoff today, you could say.
See you all in 15.
Yep.